a shot in the dark. Wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 286. We're marching towards 300. Oh, goodness, man. It's been a good day so far. Today's Friday. I was off from the day job. Managed to get myself to bed at a decent hour and slept till a decent hour. Did wake up in the middle of the night one time, like for about an hour, but went back down, kind of panicked. I thought, no, not on my day off, because sometimes I wake up about that time, 3:30, 4 o'clock, and can't go back to sleep. But I managed to go back down within an hour, at least that's what my software said. And so I'm super grateful for a nice slow day recording at the absolute last minute and just drinking some delicious Costa Rica from Commonwealth Coffee and just hanging out. All right. So, man, I tell you what, I'm telling you, just go home, go drunk, Colorado, you're home. I'm telling you, it's like we were 73 degrees. And then 60 something the next day. Then the next day there's a blizzard. I saw a meme on Facebook today that had like a conversation. It was like Mother Nature saying, "You cannot have all of the seasons in the same week." And then Colorado saying, "Hold my beer." that was spectacular. I mean, it really is. I mean, I'm used to this in some sense. I grew up in Missouri where they say, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute. But I mean, this is impressive though. I was in shorts and flip flops a few days ago and then a blizzard, like a straight up, like zero heart, barely any visibility, crazy. And I tell you what, man, I got off work last night, got in my car, my new car. First time I've really been kind of worried about driving it. And new to me car, and man, it was slick. It didn't snow that much, but I guess it was snowing while it was still warm enough to where it wasn't really sticking, but it was melting, and then it froze, and then it snowed on top of that. It was like frozen slush underneath snow, and I mean, I left work and was just gonna go get something to eat, and I was having trouble climbing up the hill. And I just kind of turned around. I kind of went a different direction and stopped. And there was just wrecks everywhere. So I went to a restaurant, just got out of the traffic and pulled into this barbecue place, which was where I wasn't trying to go to get some food, but it was there and I wasn't in a wreck. So I just pulled in and went. And I checked my phone and my gosh, on Google Maps, it was like, there were just wrecks all over the place. And I see why. I am a really conscientious driver. I'm a good driver and I understand how to drive in snow. And I have a stick shift, so I can use the gears to kind of slow myself down and not have to like tap the brakes as much. And I'm pretty good at that whole thing, right? I was sliding all over the place. Now, given I don't have four-wheel drive, but my goodness, I think I'm going to get four-wheel drive before next winter. I'm going to trade this car in. It was just insane. I mean, I was having really serious trouble keeping my car on the road and not slamming into cars in front of me. And I can't imagine the normal idiots that you see driving around day to day in this fine city of ours. It was just ridiculous. I was literally worried about my physical well-being and my car's well-being. So I limped, although I let the traffic clear some. I went to get some dinner and hung out for a long time, and then it was still just packed. And I limped the back roads just because there were so many wrecks on the highway, and people they don't see deep snow and just think they can go really fast. So four-wheel drive is not four-wheel stop, people. Just I don't think people understand that. So anyway, super, super slick. I haven't even been out of the house yet today. The roads look pretty dry from the porch, but we'll find out. So I will be heading out tonight. We're going out because we're going to the Abend Gallery. I think that's how you say it. A-B-E-N-D. Abend. Gallery on Colfax for a show called Sight Unseen. And the reason we're going to see all these paintings, in addition to, I'm sure there's going to be beautiful, cool paintings there, is Allie Cavanaugh has three paintings in this show. So massive shout out to Allie Cavanaugh. Allie Cavanaugh, an old friend of mine from way back a million years ago, back in the time when there was before there were a bunch of people with handlebar mustaches, making artisan mason jars or whatever it is these people do these days. There was a little thing called Rock and or Roll, and my friends that were in bands and stuff in St. Louis had this friend in their periphery, Allie Hamelback, and now she's gotten married a long time ago, and she's Allie Cavanaugh. And so I knew her from kind of that St. Louis kind of subculture kind of music scene. And if you listen to the show, you know, you've heard me talk about Allie. I did a whole show about Allie at one point. I keep trying to get Allie on the podcast, but Allie's resisting me. When I started doing this, is one of the best thing that's happened from the doing this show is that out of nowhere, people have kind of come out of the woodwork and that I haven't seen in a while. And one of them was Allie Hamelback or Allie Cavanaugh. And so Allie kind of shot me a message and just like said how much she loved the show. And I went and looked her up, and my gosh, I mean, she's become like this world-class artist. I mean, she's been on the cover of all these big art magazines, and she has shows all over the world. And so there's a curated show happening here in Denver tonight at the Abend Gallery. I don't know how you say that. At 6 o'clock is the opening tonight, but the show will be there for about a month, looks like. So if you're around Denver and you're hearing this, go look for my friend Allie's three paintings in at the Abend Gallery and Sight Unseen. So if you're listening to this live, and that means it's 7 o'clock mountain time, then we are at the gallery right now. So you could just get in your car, keep listening, come up to a bend and hang out. You could hang out with me, Andrew Whaley, your humble host of the Counter Position. You could hang out with me in person. How amazing would that be? Not very amazing, I promise. Anyway, so, you know, I want to revisit why I love Allie's painting so much. And because it coincides with what I think art is about. And I think that, yeah, so a famous quote that I love is from T-Bone Burnett, and I'm paraphrasing. He said, as a Christian and an artist, you can write about two things. You can write about God, or you can write about everything else. That is, you can write about the light, or you can write in the light. And so of all the things that you can portray in the light, I think that the human figure and the human face, the visual of the particularity of the human person is the most powerful thing you can show. And why is that? Because we are created in the image of God. And then later, after our creation in the image of God, God disclosed himself in the particularity of a human person. So if you want to write about God, you want to disclose God, you want to point to the being, some kind of being in God, or, you know, you want to talk about that, and you wanted to do it the way God did it, well, then you would do it by showing the human person, because that's how God did it. He created us in his image. He creates each one of us in our particularity in his image. And at one point, he literally became one of us, like us in every way except sin. So everything you have, Christ had, except sin. Every drop of it. Now, sidebar theologically, he had a human being and a human intellect and a human will and all the above. Normally, that inheres in a human person in us. Christ did not have a, he was not a human person. He had everything. He was a person and he was fully human and fully divine. And he had everything that we have as humans, but that didn't add up to his person because his person was the second person of the Trinity. His who, as opposed to, you know, as it were, the who was the second person of the Trinity. There's a little Christological kind of sticky wicket for you there. I hope I didn't commit any heresy in that little summary there. I don't think I didn't mean to. I don't think I did. Anyway, so Allie, like so many great artists before her, so like so many great Catholic artists before her, discloses the divine by showing the human. And it's just in its beautiful, painful, tragic, glorious particularity. And she is a master of that. Her paintings are heart-achingly beautiful. And they, especially this new direction she's gone in the last few years with this watercolor stuff, they're just so ethereal. So you can Google Allie Cavanaugh, go to alliecavanaugh.com, look at her paintings. I'll try to put a link up in case you haven't seen it before. And I can't say enough. Absolutely beautiful. So I mean, this is going to be the first time I've got to see these paintings in person tonight. So I'm super excited about it. All right, let's go to the break. When we get back, I got some more stuff up my sleeve. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Let my sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. The only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so, you know, I was just talking about going to see Allie Cavanaugh's paintings up at the Ben Gallery. And, you know, it's interesting. It's really interesting. This concept of like, I'm going to see her work for the first time. I've been all over her website. I've seen all of these digital images, and it's like, it's a moment like this, second only to maybe meeting a person that you've only seen on screens, but seeing an image that's painted, that has texture, that has a certain size in relationship to you. And all these things that you feel like, oh yeah, I've seen that because I saw that on the website, or I've seen that on a shirt, or I've seen that on a coffee mug, or I saw a print of that hanging on someone's wall. And then you see something up close for the first time without the filter of media. And you're like, oh, I mean, obviously a person is the deepest experience of that, but I think it's fascinating. I'm really looking forward to that experience. In fact, I went and purposely looked at the paintings that are going to be in the show and saw them on my screen and had that experience again. And then now I'm going to walk in and I didn't even notice how big they are or kind of, you know, I'm going to see these things in person. And I don't know, it seems so real to me. It seems so architectonic of an experience to me, that seeing of something firsthand and not through a filter. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going off the outline here a little bit, but as I'm wont to do. And, you know, I think that there is There's an allegory here. There's a metaphor. There's a direct kind of an analogy with the spiritual life. And I know I'm just beating the same drum I always beat, but I think this is a good way to think about it. You know, there's that song that I both don't like and get stuck in my head and like, that Good, Good Father song. It's a worship song. And it says something about, I've heard 1,000 things or 1,000,000 things about what they think you're like. You know, and it makes me think of Michael Wallstein talking about that allegory, that Aristotle wrote when he was still writing dialogues. Like Plato, he wrote his version of the allegory of the cave, and these men live underground with all everything they could need to be happy, all these beautiful things, and this light in these caverns and all this. And but they've never left, and they've heard by hearsay that there are gods above, right? I think that a good way, people ask me what we mean. I don't know who we is. I'm certainly not representing CL. I'm not representing, you know, the charismatic world, or I don't know what, but people who talk about encounter, just the collective people who use the word encounter talking about the divine, they ask us, what do you mean by that? Is that just emotion? Is it just what are you talking about? What do you mean encounter? And I guess the only way I could say it is what moralism and measuring yourself against a bunch of prescriptions of what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to experience and what you're supposed to be like and all this and what this is all supposed to be versus the encounter of the living God with a human person, which has a moral dimension, which has a dogmatic dimension, which has all these other dimensions. But that it's analogous to think about is like meeting a person for the first time when you've just seen, and maybe you've read a biography about them, you've read all about them, you've seen them in movies, maybe you've heard about them, you know people who are friends with them, and you've heard stories about them, and then you meet this person. There's a clear difference, right? It's like when you've only seen a picture on a screen, you've only seen that Michelangelo statue. You know, I'm going to go to Rome at some point. I've never been to Italy at all. There are things that I'm going to see that I have seen 1,000,000 times, like the David, the Pietà, these different sculptures and paintings and churches, the Sistine Chapel. I'm going to go there. And at some point, I'm going to see these things firsthand, and it's going to be different. And then now when I go back, you know, it's funny. I remember reading about, here's a good example. I had read the book, The Great Good Place by Ray Oldenburg. He's the sociologist that, coined the phrase, third place in reference to different places in society, like cafes and bars and beer gardens and bistros and you know, these different places that I'm interested in because of what I do for a living. Well, I do what I do for a living because I'm interested in them. And he talked about the history of the Viennese cafe, and he talked about the history of it, and he talked about the current reality and what it's like to walk into Cafe Central. And I read about Cafe Central, and then I went and I got online and I looked at pictures on Google of Cafe Central. And then at some point I went over to Vienna, and I walked up and I saw Cafe Central, and I saw it in relationship to the three-dimensional space around it and what buildings are next to it, the feeling of what's behind you when you're standing there looking at it, all those different things. And I walked in and I had the experience of seeing the place, of walking in and seeing the feeling, the way the light hits you, the way they've lit it, or the way this glass gleams, or the who's sitting at these tables and the smells in the place. You know, it's like, it's just so much more three-dimensional than reading a description of how things go down if you go to Cafe Central or looking at it as a picture, right? So I cherish experiences that have that character where you go from hearsay to direct experience of something. And don't get me wrong, man, I love me some concepts. I'm addicted to concepts. I love big thoughts. I love thoughts. I love concepts. I love speculation. I love you. I mean, if you listen to the show, you know, right? I'm not this dogged realist. That in some ways, concepts are more real to me than other things. But maybe because of that, I really love when I bump into something and my concept of it, that thing that was that painting or that person or that building or that forest or that whatever that existed as a concept in my mind, when that concept falls, I realize how far that fell short whenever you have the experience of the thing itself. I kind of cherish those experiences because I think it's a teaching moment for reality to remind me what things are about. It's pedagogical, if you want to use a big word. It's reality teaching me that there's something more than the representations of things in my head, you know? And so I'm going to have that experience tonight. I mean, there's this person, Allie Cavanaugh, who I adore and who I think is one of the most talented artists that I've ever met. And I'm a giant fan of. And then I'm going to get to see that painting firsthand. I'm going to get to see these things that I've only seen as a two-dimensional image on a screen someplace. I get to see them in person. And I really cherish that kind of an experience. So once again, so if you're listening to this live, it's means it's a little after 7. That show in Denver goes until 9 o'clock tonight. So you're more than welcome to come out. We would love to see you there. So, okay, moving on from and that same kind of a theme of concept versus reality. It's like, so I've started looking at buildings for Calyx, and we're going to do a prototype here in Denver. So I started looking at buildings that are available. And now look, we haven't even started fundraising yet. So I know that any building that's open right now, by the time we build a campaign and fundraise and get enough money that we could get our hands on that building, it probably won't be there anymore. It'll be gone by then. So I don't know why I'm distressed, but I find these buildings. I'm like, oh, that would be perfect. Oh man, it's in the perfect place. Like, you know, and then I call on it and all I'm doing is calling to find out what's available. Find out, kind of get some information about this. I just want to call a bunch of buildings in the right places, find out what things kind of cost and what the basic idea behind the leases and all this stuff is, so that I can kind of extrapolate some ideas and then put them into a business plan. So then we can then create a campaign and we can raise some money and then we can go do it. And so the chances are that in a real estate market as hot as Denver, that any of these buildings that I'm interested in still being there after, it's like slim to none that any of these things will ever still exist, you know, as available on the market. But I had one that I really was stoked on, just both because of the location and what it was, you know, what it was near. And, you know, I was just really excited about this building. And I called, they never even got a sign up. I saw it on Craigslist, called, and it was already kind of pretty much off the market. So I fight this process because I'm like, oh, this could be. I mean, the minute I see someplace, I get a vision for it. I'm like, we could do this. And that's never going to be reality. Okay, dang. So, oh, goodness. We're at the end of the segment. Let's head off to the break. Well, you're listening to The Counter Position.
Then how we crave a hanging in its dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
People singing, please don't sting, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go. Third segment. I want to pick up a little bit on the conversation about looking for a building for Calix. So it's interesting. I love. I was watching last night the new season of The Mind of a Chef, and halfway through the season, I just kind of jumped in halfway through because they switched to David Kinch from Manresa, and Manresa is like one of the most ideological. Like in the sense of like, it's not ideology, but it's a very, very particular restaurant in Santa Cruz, California. It's in Los Gatos, I think, actually, just north of there. And so David Kinch and Manresa, they grow pretty much everything they use or source it like super locally. I think all of the bulk of the produce they use and everything is grown on their own farms and everything, and they pick it. He'll go on and on and on about what happens in the degrading of the a flavor of a carrot if you put it on refrigeration. Like they pick everything that day and then use it. Like they don't even have refrigerators for that kind of stuff, you know. And it's funny because there's a chef that is opening a new restaurant in LA called Simone, and her name is Jessica Largy, and she grew up in Fillmore, California, the same town that our friend Perry West is from, and where I had a coffee house for a while. And so some of her sisters would come in, and then sometimes she would come in with her sisters, and I knew she had been at La Mille in LA and had then moved over to Bastide, which is a serious French restaurant in LA. And she ended up going up to Manresa. Now she's moved on and done some other stuff, and she's got her own place starting up. But it was so funny when we were shooting the video for Shrine Coffee for the fundraising video in Santa Cruz. They sent me off to the downtown Verve to sit around and do some work and walk around and talk to some people. And they sent the videographer with me to kind of capture video of me working and hanging out and talking to these people. And I ran into Jessica Largy. Like she was just happened to be in to coming to get a coffee, you know. And so it was strange to see. I just now bumped into her boss, her old boss. He's in the second half of this new season of Mind of a Chef, right? And he was just talking about kind of what they built and kind of why they built it and his experience of the legacy and these, you know, what people experience when they come and the experience that people have working there and, you know, the, you know, sending people off. And it's interesting. It's got me think. I was already in the mode of like designing this first prototype in my mind, and I've got so many different ideas on so many different ways, so many different types of places that Calix could build and so many different types of places in particular situations that I want people to build inspired by what we do. And it's just interesting to think about like, what do I need to build and how do I, and where does it need to be so that it will, people will understand and be interested and be inspired to do these other things, right? It's beyond yourself. You're already thinking, I'm thinking about what's going to happen in this room, but I'm thinking about how this affects what happens outside of this room. What other rooms will come to exist because of what was seen here. I mean, I can look at the different shops that I've designed and built and I can go, oh yeah, that shelving over there next to that, I got the idea from such and such, or yeah, we did the workflow, the customer flow, like kind of like they did over at such and such, except I reversed it to put it with, you know, I can see shadows of experiences that I've had in the shape of the places that I've designed. So I know how much that, people put into these things, you know? And so the location, the building and the location of the building are so, so important. And I'm pulling the trigger on something I've been working on for over 20 years. And so I want to openly ask everyone who listens to this show to pray for me and to pray for Calix, to pray that we would find the right place, the right building, that the right donors would come along to give us what we need when we need it, and that the right doors would open up for us to build something that will be impactful. We're trying to build a prototype. We're building a model. This is going to be about having a community there and having a space that does the thing that we're talking about. But we want to build it in a way to kind of showcase what's possible so people can come visit it. People can see it. We can capture video. We can capture photographs. We can write about interactions, and we can tell people, no, we're doing it. It is possible. And if you're listening the first time, you're probably confused all the hell by this point, but Calyx, we build spaces where people who are deeply unchurched or dechurched can interact with people who have faith and who kind of approach reality in that way. And they can slowly over time earn the right to be heard with each other and come to know each other, where real conversation can lead to real dialogue. Real dialogue can lead to relationship in community. And that's the context. That's the proper context for anything like evangelization or discipleship or any kind of conversion to take place. A space where people can experience a presence. And that goes back to what I was talking about with Allie's work and that I'm going to experience tonight. And the idea of encounter is that we don't just want to create a space where you can come here and some information that you didn't ask an answer. The answers that you don't accept to a question you didn't ask are posed. It's like, great. We're not interested in that. We want you to come here, spend time and to experience a presence that's maybe bigger than the sum of the parts. Right. Now, something that kind of got me thinking about that is something that I've talked about a few times here is I look at the idea of that in my mind, and I just, the idea of a bunch of people coming, getting their laptops out, putting their headphones in, and just sitting there isolated from everyone else in the room just drives me absolutely nuts. Even though I do that, I work in cafes like that, but that's not what I remember. The experience that I have that I remember in a cafe is when I had a beautiful conversation. When I was reading a book and someone walked by and said, oh, I read that book. What do you think about such and such? And we started talking and I found some kind of synergy with someone or a conversation, or over time you bump into that person again and again. You know, that's why it's meaningful. And so I've started the conversation with my board and the people around me, and we're strongly considering, or at least I'm strongly considering, just not having Wi-Fi. Now, there's a shop right by my house, Pablo's, right over here on 6. They don't have Wi-Fi. They're packed all the time, right? There's a bunch of cafes in New York who have cut the cord and even banned laptops. They're busy. They're busier than they were. I think people are sick of having a filter of technology between them and the people around them. Some of them just don't know that they're sick of it yet. And so, I don't know, we're kind of kicking around. In my crazier moments, I'm kicking around the idea of putting in a space, very simple menu, filling the walls and the ceiling with screen and tinfoil so that no signals get in and out, and putting on the door no laptop, no Wi-Fi, no phones, no laptops, no earbuds, no electronic devices, and maybe even go as far as, you know, no to-go cups. Just if you want to have something, if you want to consume something, you're going to eat and drink here with us. You know, if not, you know, maybe bring something to put it in. that's crazy. That's like going really over the top, right? But there's another, that's, you see that again. There's some spaces that are going to, you lose so much money from credit card processing fees. And it's such a, you know, that's what I was thinking about, like doing cash only too. That's the question. You use so much money from credit card processing fee. And I got to thinking about this, and it's like the difference between, I've been thinking about this ever since that last guy threw his credit card at me on the phone the other day. You've heard me talk about this if you listen to this show. There's something about, I get it. I mean, cash is a representation, just like number, a card having zeros and ones and some, you know, being linked to some numbers in an account someplace is still a representation. But there's something in our society where we think of cash as we value it. We see how much it is. We see money in our hand. And there's something so much more human about walking into someplace, holding value that you worked for in your hand, seeing how much it is, and then handing someone your value in exchange for the value of what they're giving you. I think that that is such a more human way to have a business interaction. So I don't know. I don't know how much of this will make it through the filter of my board and everybody, but I'm strongly considering doing a little coffeehouse bookstore. And there's a problem. If you have books, you're going to kind of have to have credit cards, because a book purchase can get expensive quick, and who carries a few hundred bucks on them all the time? You know, if someone buys a few expensive academic books, I mean, it gets out of hand quick. So we might be able to have that available for book purchases or something. But still, then you're losing a lot of money on it. I tell you, I want to put an ATM outside, or find a spot with an ATM next door. So I can be like, oh, there's an ATM right there. It's like, go get some. You know, we don't have to-go cups. Have a seat. How are you doing today? You know? I think that's evangelical. I think that that interaction would be, in the proper sense of the word, Catholic. Anyway, let's go to the break. We'll see what happens when we get back. You're listening to The Counter Position.
Then all the color glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love bedecked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. Well, I can hear upstairs the dulcet tones of the lovely and talented Perry West. He snuck in while I was recording. I guess he took off early today. And he's upstairs playing, or maybe just home for lunch, playing some guitar. I love the sound of real music in a house. Anyway, so I guess I got it completely out of kilter today. Normally I do my chatty first segment, then I do the news and stuff, and then I do some kind of a deeper story, look at some principles, and then I get deep and theological and hard on my sleeve in the last segment. I'm doing it the other way around today. So we're going to the news a little bit now. I'm staying away from politics today. I'm done. I'm just like done. So a couple of cool stories that I saw in the last week I wanted to point out. One of them is that NASA made an announcement that the Spitzer Space Telescope has revealed the first known system of seven Earth-sized planets around a single star. So these are seven planets of our size around this star. And out of that, three of them are in this habitable zone. They call it the Goldilocks zone, where liquid water is most likely to exist on a rocky planet. Now, why does that matter? Because that's the secret sauce for the possibility of life, is liquid water and this Goldilocks zone where it's not too hot and it's not too cold. It's just right. Remember the story of Goldilocks. This is to, you know, this one's just right, right? So it's the Goldilocks zone, they call it. But what I thought was really fascinating about this is the exoplanet system is called TRAPPIST-1. Now, it's named for the transiting planets and planetesimal small telescope, TRAPPIST, in Chile. So there's a telescope in Chile called TRAPPIST, and I guess TRAPPIST-1 is the first one they found. But so there's a bona fide three, not one, but three planets that now they're 40 light years away. So, I mean, it's not a, it's not an easy out in case we mess this place up. It's not like we can just pack up and move. It's 40 light years away, but still, it's kind of cool to be living in this time. I think there's two different reactions to this is that, either people say, oh, well, we're just, now we're finding out that we're not that special, that things aren't as magical as they thought, that there's a bunch of these things. And we thought that this was just really just kind of unique and therefore special and amazing and wonderful. But it turns out we're just another kind of planet and these exist and blah, blah, blah. And I think that that just discloses, you know, a certain mentality, right? It's like if you met one person that could do magic, they could just make their coffee cup float in the air. And then it turns out, actually, everyone in my family can make the coffee cup float. And you're like, really? Well, that's not nearly as special because more people can do. It's like, well, actually, we found 10 families on Earth kind of spread out that can all use their mind to make the cup float in the air. We could do magic. Really? Well, that's kind of boring now because there's a bunch of people who can do it. And the other reaction would be, wow, that's cool. What? There's 7 people in your family could do that? That is 7 times more cool than I thought it was. What? There are more families? This is amazing. I mean, it's like there's so much more beautiful stuff, cool stuff happening. So the fact that there's a, you know, it makes me think of G.K. Chesterton talking about in Orthodoxy, the ethics of Elfland, you know, and he says that the nursery is the most logical place in the world. You ask a kid, why do apple trees make apples? And they'll look at you without flinching and say, because they're magic. You know, but all the apple trees make apples. Of course they do. They're all magic. Well, all the fruit trees make fruit after their own kind. I know they're all magic. It's like, I think you can choose to see mundanity or you can choose to see wonder. I choose to see wonder. Sometimes that wonder is not, out in the middle of nowhere. Sometimes it's hiding under our own nose here. And you know what? That's pretty interesting because there's been another discovery I want to talk about. And it turns out people are making an argument for an 8th continent. And it is pretty much under New Zealand. And they call it Zealandia. And there's the question is like, we've kind of thought about continents being, you know, sticking up out of the ocean, right? But they're saying that most of this continent of Zealandia, the islands around including New Zealand and those around it are part of it sticking up. But they're saying that if you look at it under the ground and what the difference between the Earth's crust and this land and all this other, this is a bona fide real landmass that is definitely distinct from the ocean floor, and it's got topography and all that stuff. It is a landmass, and it's submerged in the South Pacific. It may not have always been submerged. It may not always be submerged. And it is, in fact, a continent. And I'm just like, well, I'm a little less overwhelmed by this because it's like, okay, now you're just... Okay, I mean, it was already there. We already knew it was there, did we? I don't know. But it's like now you're kind of messing with the definition of what we would call a continent at this point. But I mean, it doesn't changes anything, I guess. But we see everything in relation to us when we're talking about land. It's like, well, great, can we go there? Great, so I could dive and look at it in a submarine or a, you know, scuba diving. Well, that sounds fun. So basically it would be the ground I would see if I went scuba diving. You kind of think of it from the perspective of your human experience of the thing, right? But there you go. It's like, it's there, right? And whether I can experience it or not doesn't change what it is. it is an object of reality. It does exist. It has these other characteristics other than the fact that I can go walk on it. I guess, you know, I don't know, but it's interesting. I just saw these two different news stories come across in the same week. So maybe there's an eighth continent. We definitely found seven more exoplanets about our size. Three of them are habitable. They're Goldilocks zone planets. I just think it's kind of cool. So, oh goodness, what else do I want to talk about? I've got a bunch of choices in about 3.5 minutes. So LifeSite, I'll get not political, but ecclesial political, because it kind of annoyed me. And I should have jumped into this right after I was talking about the human person and the disclosure of the human person through picturing the human person and the image and the visual of a human person. So LifeSite News had this article just like griping this. I don't know what it was implying. There was something was inappropriate, but it had this, these circus performers perform for Pope Francis. And it kept saying that there were these women in skin tight costumes. And I saw the picture and some of the video, and it's like, it was zany, kind of like, they're all like, you know, some of the costumes were really outrageous and they were all super brightly colored. And some of the, some of the women's costumes, like where their breasts were, it was like these giant like eyes and stuff and different things. And it was just like, and it was all zany and whimsical and stuff. And it was kind of, which I thought was kind of funny. I thought that was actually kind of ingenious to put, an eye looking back in some place where your eye might be averted to when you're not looking someone in the eye, because you're like, you would look down to see another eye looking at you. I thought that was kind of whimsically kind of telling or funny, but they were just, people were just freaking out over this, these skin tight costumes. And it just kept repeating it. And so then this got linked online, and some of my friends were taking sides on it and arguing it, from mostly people from around my alma mater. And I was amazed. So then someone posted a video of Benedict the 16th with these four guys with their shirts off and these skin tight pants doing all this acrobatic stuff in front of him. And it was like, oh, what about that? Your boy Benedict the 16th had the same kind of show. And they kind of backpedaled on like, well, he was probably just sick of that stuff and that's why he quit, you know? And I just, and then I posted the famous video of the break dancers breaking for John Paul II. And, I thought, you know, and people were like, well, that's when it kind of began, when it went downhill. And it's like, so where is this idea? Two things that I came away with, I just want to talk about real fast. A, God, we are obsessed with sex in the human body. This, people are so upset that the Pope would see someone in a skin tight costume. Oh, heaven forbid that one of our clerics might realize that, I don't know, women have hips and breasts or something. I know, it's as if we don't know what a human person looks like, as if it's something shameful and icky that has to be hidden under all occasions. That freaked me out. And the other side is like this idea that ecclesial reality should exist in this pristine kind of like white marble with frescoes reality, and nothing should penetrate that of normal life, like music or dance or anything that isn't like what normally happens there should just stay out of that. It just freaked me out. But anyway, you can look that story up if you want to. You know what? We're out of time. Let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. See you on the other side.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.